Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast with me, Russell Guyver, with my co-host, as always, Peter Marsh. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Russ. How you doing?
Good. Not too bad. Just back from Italy. Good trip. Missed the Spurs game, though. But you were there. We'll get more details on that coming up soon. And also welcoming a guy I've known for quite a while, but it's his first time coming on the podcast, a debutante in the shape of Tom Hyland. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing? It's been a while coming.
It has. We kept saying we were going to do this, and it's been quite some time. And I've just noticed, actually, literally about 10 minutes before I fired up this Zoom call, that you've just recently been on the Albion Roar. So they got back in again before I've got you on. Yes, our girlfriend's ADN now. But yeah, I mean, why not? It's great to get you back get you on here as well. To tell us really about all your backstory and all the rest of it, and we're also going to talk about various other things as well. But yeah, let's start with your Albion history. Where did it all begin, Tom?
So it's actually with the Scouts, weirdly. So when I was 10 in the Scouts, our Scout leader, massive Brighton fan, and there was always that Friday night Christmas game at Withdean, and every year, without fail, we'd go to that game because Scouts was on a Friday and he wasn't going to miss that game. So he took us all along with him. Right. So I think the first game was, Chesterfield. The season after all of that cheek in malarkey. So quite a heated game. I think there was a red card, a few goals. And that was my introduction to the Albion. And then from there, you know, going every year, maybe a couple of times a year with the Scouts. And then it wasn't until I was at university that I really started going to games properly. So coming from a rugby family, I'd always been playing rugby, refereeing rugby, and weekends were kind of dedicated to rugby. I found myself, though, injured, out for a season. So I had an option. I either got a season ticket at Harlequins or a season ticket at the Albion. And the thing that swung it was the travel was included to the Albion. So there was my, like, I think it was £119 or something for a student back then, paid that. And that was my first season ticket to the Withdean. And from there, I've just not stopped going. I've suddenly realised that having a few beers and watching game is probably more enjoyable than running around and getting hurt for 80 minutes on a Saturday. So that's kind of where I really got involved. From there, started going away, probably the League One winning season. So back in, was it 2010, 2011, started going to away games properly. Then what a season to start doing that. And then through a mixture of the away games and pre-season tours to Geneva, to Spain, basically found kind of an Albion family, as it were. So there's a big group of us now that go to games, really good mates with, and that's kind of what football is for me. It's that chance to go and see people once a week, have a few beers, have a chat, and inevitably the middle part of the 90 minutes has the chance to ruin the day. But
which often obliges as well. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we keep hearing this over and over again, this sort of this point that, you know, it is about the social, isn't it? It's not just the football. Yeah, we can appreciate it, especially at the moment when we have an all-time high in terms of positions in the table and quality of football. But in general, regardless of that, and it usually does ruin it more than not, it is great to get together, to form friendships, expand friendships into, you know, other social groups as well, and just getting chatting with random strangers, which is what I did with you. You mentioned pre-season friendlies. I think that's when we first got chatting, when we were in the West Lower, and I think you were sitting directly in front of us, and you're accusing us of being chatterboxes, but I can't believe that's possibly the case. I can't even remember who I was with, actually, but we probably were chatting away too much, because I do seem to do that quite often. Yeah, we got chatting, didn't we, talking about the Albion, and you'd got the new kit. I can't remember the details of conversation, but yeah, that was a good few years ago now. Was it Villarreal?
I can't remember. I think it might have been before that. I just hope it wasn't my my Elvis Manu kit that I bought once. That was a mistake.
Oh, God.
If you didn't spend as much as Albion spent on Elvis Manu anyway.
Yeah, well, the shirts aren't exactly cheap, though.
Nor was Manu.
And neither of us got any value from it.
Absolutely, yeah. It really was. That was a disastrous signing, wasn't it? It might well have been that shirt. I can't remember. If it was, I've blanked it out of my mind.
Back in the day when £2 million was actually quite a big signing for us, rather than a kind of like reserve team player who's probably never going to be seen again.
Yeah, exactly. So, Tom, whereabouts, in terms of location, where were you living, where were you brought up as well? Were you a Brightonian yourself? Or
Yeah, so been in Burgess Hill all my life. Born in Sussex, lived in Sussex all my life. So my brother would try and tell you otherwise and say there was a period of time where there was a Man United shirt worn, but that was forced on me from my dad when I was young enough that I didn't have the choice. But really, it's only Albion for me.
Hang on, is this why you had Elvis Manu on the back of your shirt? Was it subconscious? Are you sure you weren't?
I thought he was going to be the next best thing. It turns out that he was more like Man United in more that ways than it seemed at the time.
Yeah, indeed, they went downhill fast as well, didn't they? As did Elvis. But so a Burgess Hill boy, born and bred, and still live in that area.
Yeah, so still in Burgess Hill. So nice and easy to get to and from games. I think just pretty much anywhere in Sussex is a good place to live, really.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when there's a train strike on, which is not the reason I didn't make it down to the game on Saturday, which we'll talk about a bit later on. But that's because I was away on holiday. But so many people probably weren't able to get to that match. There's a load of stuff to talk about in relation to that, and we'll get on to that in a minute. But just carrying on the theme of you and the Albion, Tom, in terms of favourite memories, favourite players, cult hero moments, most amusing, not very favorite moments. But yeah, what stands out for you?
So the first player that I kind of really remember properly, and the first player that kind of resonated with, was probably Richard Carpenter. He's the one that stood out from those days of going with the scouts, and I think it was just, you know, his ability from free kicks and dead balls. He had that ability to just create something out of nothing. And in those days, that's pretty much what we relied on, because we weren't exactly being prolific, especially when we're in the championship and that. But in terms of moments, I think that opening day of the Premier League, walking out, that was quite emotional. I would have said the Wigan game, but I was on a glacier in Iceland. So that's probably the low point, was missing the promotion game. But I was listening to BBC Sussex on the middle of a glacier in Iceland. I had two friends that have no interest in football. They were with me. They didn't quite get it. I had my Albion flag stuffed in my pocket, and at full time got that flag out, had it up, and had a photo on the glacier, and then inflicted the Huddersfield game on the radio to my two friends as well. And when that game finished and I had some tears running down my eyes, they were literally looking at me going, what on earth are you doing? What's up with your life? But it was still such an incredible moment, even though I wasn't there, but was able to make up for it at Norwich. I don't particularly remember the game because the celebrations on the train up to Norwich were probably partially to do. And I think I remember that game, we got given vouchers for a free drink in the stand. And after a bottle of champagne and a few beers beforehand, it was the last thing I needed. But I was like, Pony's bought it. We need to make sure we use it.
He ruined not to do it, wouldn't he? Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that's probably the most drunk I've been at a football match, that Norwich game. It was not a good idea it being Friday night as well. That was a bad idea. I think I had to take a half day off work and was pretty drunk before the game. And definitely by the time I got to bed, I was barely stand, I think.
I do know that that day was also hilarious because we went back to the pub afterwards because we were staying up there because you had to. And the bouncer came over and was like, it's coming up to like 11:30 at night. We need you to be quiet. So we started silent chanting. So everyone's jumping around this pub chanting songs, but without any words actually coming out of their mouth. And that was hilarious. And then midnight comes, and Norwich is great for an away day because midnight you can walk up the high street and go into a curry house. So midnight, but suddenly they're having a curry. And I mean, it was just another great, great away day, or away weekend, really.
Yeah, it certainly was. And yeah, it's a shame about the results, but nevertheless. But it didn't matter, did it? It didn't really matter because we've already got promoted. It was just a matter of whether we could get over the line with that title.
We did get to see our team lose 2-0 without having conceding a shot on target, though, which not many people can say.
Yeah. And he was on a hat trick, wasn't he? Girls, Stocker's so close. Never mind. Next time.
Talking of players being on hat tricks, another moment that I think for me is up there as a disappointment is when we played Liverpool in the FA Cup and Liam Bridcutt scored 2 own goals.
Yeah.
And then Steven Gerrard stepped up and took the penalty. I'm still aggrieved that they did not give it to Bridcutt because he was on a hat trick.
That could have been quite funny, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, happy days indeed. That story about Iceland, and we're speaking on the eve of you going to Iceland. So clearly you like the place. I don't know if that was your first visit the previous time, but happy memory. It's got to be quite a unique and special way to celebrate it if you can't be at the game. Absolutely.
Yeah. It was, it was a long booked trip. Hmm. So I had no say in it. Otherwise, probably would have gone to the game if it was just me. But that weekend, I forced my friends to watch the Wolves game in a pub in Reykjavik and then forced them to listen to the games on the Monday as well. So it was all round a good weekend. But yeah, so Iceland is always good to miss a game of football. So we'll probably win on Friday as well.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. It's beautiful country. Recommend anyone who goes if they haven't. Yeah, so that's good on the story, the background, and brings us up to date. Now, Tom, last time I keep bumping into you at games. It's almost turned into a running joke the amount of times I've seen you since that friendly. Most recently, it wasn't at the game, but it was just afterwards. Was the Leicester match just a few weeks ago in the Evening Star post match where we had a goal chat? And little do we know that shitloads were going to happen by the time I get you on this pod. What, 4 weeks later or whatever it is, 4 or 5 weeks later. Obviously, Graham Potter's gone. We've got the new guy in. Amazing start. Albeit the result wasn't as good as it might possibly have been against Liverpool. But then we bounced back from that, you know, off the walls. And then we get the Spurs game, and it's a bit of a letdown on the scoreline. And some people moaning, actually, about the performance. I didn't really have the issues that some people have with the game. And we'll get into that now. But you and Peter were both at the match. Just the general overview, what do you make of the game and what have you made of De Zerbi so far across the two matches?
I think for me, the Spurs game is one that you just consign to the history books and move on and don't give too much thought to it. It's not going to define our season. The performance was still there. It's always been a struggle, us breaking down teams that sit back and let us attack onto them. So I don't think we can read too much into it. And ultimately, De Zerbi still finding his feet. I think what we did at Liverpool, that first 25 minutes, is probably up there with the best 25 minutes of football I've ever seen the Albion play. So you can't have that one week and then be upset the next when you have a Champions League team come in and setting up to just stop you. I mean, that's a bit of a compliment in itself.
Certainly is. And actually, a complete contrast, ironically, wasn't it, that we started pretty slowly in that Spurs game for about the same period of time as that period of ecstasy at Liverpool, you could call it, that you just described. It's going to be like that, isn't it, with him, with De Zerbi? It's going to be lots of flamboyant changes and differences in performance and results and goal line, I think, as it goes along. This game, I mean, it was unchanged, I think, wasn't it, the team, which makes sense. You can't really drop people, I wouldn't say, unless there's a reason to need to do so. So I think the lineup was probably the right one to go with as such. But Roberto was sort of like admitting that he wasn't really, he made a mistake with his anticipation of the game. He thought that Spurs would set up with 3-4-2-1. He did set up with a 3-5-2 to counteract us and to flood the midfield. And, you know, particularly in those early stages, that certainly is how it worked out. And he was able to get a grip on the game by doing that, Conte, as you said, in the Italian derby, Italian manager's derby anyway. Disappointing. And I think ultimately for me, we lost the game in that period because they got their noses in front, ironically, towards the end of the period of dominance. And then and it was Peter's best mate, Kane. He must be so delighted to lose to a winner from Kane, Peter. But, we've struggled to get back into the game because Spurs are a very good team. As you said, they're a Champions League team that were setting themselves up to stop us. They had that strength in midfield and they were very, very good in defence. And the notion of always wanting a pass more, going back to kind of previous times, we kind of had to, really, because it was either that or have a shot that's going to get blocked, it seemed to me. And we really struggled because we put ourselves in that position of needing to chase the game. Spurs could then sit and play on the counter, which plays into their hands, doesn't it? But I don't know. Peter, apart from your delight at seeing Kane score the winner, how was it all for you?
Yeah, it was a bit of a nothing match, really. Nothing. Not much happened, in all honesty. You know, Sanchez didn't make any particularly great saves, nor did Lloris. It was, you know, there was a lot of shots, but nothing. I never really felt that we looked like we were going to score. The nearest we got was probably March's shot, which was just wide when the keeper was completely run-footed and would have definitely gone in if it had crept in the corner. I think there was an extra touch a lot of the time. And whereas the kind of players like someone like March, for example, where I was told, or it sounded like he basically had a real go at players very quickly at Liverpool, he kind of took time on the ball and allowed players to get back. And quite often when we broke through their line, we then played too slowly, which is not the way De Zerbi, I think, wants to play, to then really take advantage of the space that we had. We kind of let them get back and they were quite good at getting back from there. It obviously is flattering that Spurs played. I'm surprised they did, to be honest, because they were a better team for 25 minutes when they were playing just like kind of open football. And if they carried on playing the way they were, I think probably they could have won by more. It was, you know, generally it wasn't the best way of playing. There was, I think, where certainly me and a few other people were at one side and other people had the other side, was just De Zerbi's comments after the game where he said we were fantastic. And I felt that wasn't the case, whether that got lost in translation or he didn't quite mean fantastic. I thought we weren't terrible. No, I'm not having a go. I'm not criticising the team. And if he'd not said fantastic, I probably wouldn't have commented either way. But we definitely weren't fantastic in my view. That was, you know, we were a better team because for that part of the game, because Spurs sat back and defended and gave us the ball, and because they didn't think we could break them down, and they were right. But we were no way fantastic. Too many players had an off game. I think Conte, as to be fair, De Zerbi admitted, got it right with the starting team and playing the extra man in midfield where our goals had come from. Too many players like Casado, I wondered if he was still ill or was it injured or if he was during the week, because he struggled a bit, didn't have his best game. Trossard didn't really get into it. Welbeck didn't get great service, but when he did, the ball bounced off him quite a lot. So it just felt like too many of our players had slightly off days. And when you're playing someone like Tottenham, you've got to be all be on it, basically. And yeah, they weren't.
I mean, would you go along with that, Tom? Because I mean, I was watching on a dodgy stream in Italy, and it's a little bit hard to kind of follow the flow a bit because it kept throwing us back in time a moment or two. I think we were about 15 minutes behind the game by the time they finished doing that. But it was a bit interruptive. But to me, I didn't get the impression that there was a huge amount wrong, apart from that first period, which got us into the situation of changing the game. But I felt, yeah, there was going to be some stray passes, some giveaways, some dispossessions, all that sort of thing. But I didn't really feel as if we played badly. Fantastic is obviously a bit over the top, but maybe that's just flamboyant Italian exaggeration, or he wants to pick the players up to keep the confidence up. I don't know. Or, as Peter said, lost in translation. But what did you make of it overall?
I think the big difference between the Liverpool game and the Spurs game was when we attacked against Liverpool, we had 40 metres behind them to run into, and we were able to attack with pace and exploit that. Spurs didn't afford us that time or that space with the ball, so we couldn't inject that pace into the game, which is where I think, you know, we do best quick passes, flicks on, and getting in behind the line, and we just couldn't do that because they were so solid. I agree, the first half especially, we were overrunning midfield, and that showed, and we struggled to kind of overcome that. But the second half, when they started making subs, they took off a central midfielder and went to, I think, the expected formation that De Zerbi was expecting from them. And at that point, we were the only team that was ever likely to do something, but it was more like the start of last season, where we just struggled to break down the team. We couldn't find an answer to create that space or that chance. And I think, you know, it was played well in two thirds of the pitch, and then just couldn't find the answers in that final third, which is kind of the Albion way of a year or so ago. But I think, you know, that's probably what De Zerbi needs to work out, and hopefully is what he can bring as a more attack-minded coach, because, you know, a week ago, the incision and the speed was unlike anything we had seen under...
It was unreal, wasn't it?
Yeah. And we need to find a way to do that and to present those opportunities in the middle of the box, not around the wings, I suppose.
Yeah. It has to be said also, I suppose, that most teams who come and sit deep against us aren't as good at it as Tottenham are. I mean, they are, you know, it's very unusual for a top six team to sit that deep for an hour of the game, basically, as someone like us. And I was quite surprised how deep they sat, how much they let us control the midfield at times in the second half. I was quite surprised, but maybe that was an attempt to try and break that when they brought Richarlison on for Bissouma. But then they did then go and bring on Perisic for Son, who's a bit more defensive as well. So they kind of went backwards again. So,
well, with my dodgy stream, they made that same substitution twice. It chucked me back a minute or two. And
they should be banned from the league then and give the points to us. Harry Kane should be banned from football for 50 years.
You're saying about the breaking down, you're right. I mean, for a top side, one of the top sides, to sit in that deep, it's going to be harder, yes, because they're better players in numbers. But again, when you look at the stats, 59% possession. Liverpool had 54%, I think it was, last week, didn't they? I think that's right. So again,
it's not just 59% possession. It's also, given the first 20 minutes or so, they must have had quite a lot of it as well. So the remaining 65 after they scored, we must have had a lot, like more than 59 sort of thing.
Yeah, and over total shots, 14 to their 8 and 4 shots on target to their 3. So obviously our ratio of getting shots on target wasn't as good, but we did get more of them on there. But it was just a little bit frustrating. And block shots is the other one. 5 block shots to their 1. So again, going back to this thing of the compressed space, it is difficult to break those teams down. It's not easy to get an answer to it, really, is there? I mean, I think to a certain degree, Graham Potter could sometimes do that with his teams. Roberto De Zerbi will be the same with some teams. The games coming up will be probably a much better measure of him, not only because he would have more longevity and they would have started to understand more and more about what he wants to do in the next few games, but also, of course, their games that aren't against Tottenham and Liverpool. You know, you've got Forest, we've got Brentford. Those sort of games, I know we've got City after that, but those next two games are going to be important. I think we need to get 4 points from them to start with. I feel more confident that if we can get somewhere back to the way we played against Liverpool in terms of the snappiness and the rapidity of the passing and the movement and transitions across the field, if we can get back to that against Nottingham Forest and Brentford, I do think we'll be able to get in behind them, even though they might sit on us, sit deep on us, because they're not as good as Spurs in that regard. Peter?
I was going to say, I'm not even sure Potter worked out the coming from behind bit. Barring the West Ham game, even in that really good run, I don't think we all came from behind except West Ham at home.
Well, we had a few
and
draws.
Arguably they were, you know, basically they played so many games, they looked shattered second half. Mm. And I mean, I don't think many of his wins, last season I can only think of Burnley away and West Ham home that we came from behind to win. Yeah. There aren't many. We came from behind to draw a lot, in fairness, nicking late goals, but we didn't come from behind to win very often. So it's been something we've struggled with almost at the whole Premier League time we've been in Premier League. Once teams go ahead against us, we do struggle to break them down.
I think, if you look at the Leicester game, for example, you just mentioned earlier.
Leicester, of course. Yeah, I forgot that one.
Yeah, I mean, they're leaky as hell in terms of their defence. So they were a team, even though they came at us, they're quite good going forward, they got in front. We were able to come from behind and take the lead in that game, yes, but then we gave another goal away, but then we carried on scoring. I don't think Leicester are a very good team defensively, simple as that. That's the problem.
They definitely weren't that day.
No, certainly not, and against Spurs the week after. But, it's going to be interesting to see how it develops over time, because he's coming up against different opposition. He's going to approach it with certain different nuances and tactics within his overall framework, isn't he? Also, it's going to be interesting to see where the schedule starts to get more compressed, which is the one thing that hasn't been the case for us, certainly hasn't with all those weeks we had off. But it's going to become so just before and then obviously again after the World Cup. Mm. Because we've got Brentford on Friday, which we'll preview a little bit later on, which is quite an advantage, I think, because it gives us the extra day before we face Forest. And it is a fairly local away game, so we're not going to really lose much by the travel back time a day earlier. And then we got Forest on Tuesday, and then we got a game on Sunday, which is against City. So it's the first time we've had this midweek fixture to deal with since De Zerbi's been in charge, obviously, because he only just started. We're playing a high-energy style, aren't we, Tom? And do you think we're going to find it difficult to keep that intensity up and play the Liverpool-style game that we did when we're getting more density of fixtures?
I don't know. I think there was a stat that said that we've used the fewest players of any team in the league so far. So we've got consistency in that. But in terms of the kind of regular games, it also means there's a lot of players that are quite fresh as well. And I think that's one of our strengths, especially in that kind of mini section of the league that we're in. I think we have good replacements on the bench and in our squad that can come in and offer a similar amount of quality in a lot of the positions that we'll need it. So I think that's kind of a positive. I think one thing that we'll find out is maybe the flexibility of De Zerbi in the way he plays, because we know that Potter had three or four variations of his formation and his tactics that he could deploy each game. And actually, I think that's something that's going to be tested over the next few weeks with the different opposition that we have. And I think that's something that's probably a question mark that has to be asked. And I think, you know, from what we've seen, it's positive so far. From what you've seen with his other teams, I think he has that. But it's just going to take time to get used to the squad. And I think he needs to grow to trust the squad to be able to use them and utilise that.
Yeah, I was just going to use the word utilisation of the squad there, because I think there's a few conundrums that are looming in their head here at the moment, aren't there? We've got Mitoma, who's been pretty much brilliant whenever we've seen him play. I think probably the biggest letdown was he was just only good against Forest Green Rovers. But he's been very, very good in all the other appearances, but he's only come on as a sub. So there might be a question mark about whether he can do a whole 90 at that intensity of Premier League level, I don't know. But at some point, he's got to be given a chance to do that in order to make that match fitness, match sharpness. And the question would then be, who would drop out? Could it be someone like Solly, who maybe either just because he might just go off the boil or might need a rest. Might that be a way that you could get him into the team? Possibly you then play a different formation slightly. Would that work possibly? Because Solly has been one of the players who's looking like he might develop under De Zerbi from what we're seeing and hearing. There was an interview on the Unlimited podcast this week with Solly as well, which was interesting. You know, he's certainly enjoying it there. And I think he's playing his best football in those early stages of this season in general, and not least with Roberto De Zerbi. That could be one way we could fit him in. Do you change anything with a double pivot? Do you play? I mean, he's played with back four and a back three. Interestingly, he didn't start with a four, did he, in this game as such? He had mainly the three with the wing backs again, but he was successful against Liverpool with essentially a version of four, wasn't it, really there? If you're playing with four at the back, maybe in that scenario, you change things up and that might suit Mitoma more. I'm not sure. That's one of a number of conundrums, isn't it, to balance up. And getting people like Undav involved, if he fancies him as an option off the bench or as a replacement in the game. I guess he'll play against Arsenal in the League Cup match, but, you know, we need to have those replacements ready in case they're needed as well, don't we?
Yeah, and I think the joy is that so many players can play so many different positions. That's one thing that we've learned over the last year or so. I mean, Solly March came to us as a winger. He's found his feet playing wing-back. He's played full-back. Trossard has played across those positions as well. Pascal Gross as another example. And I think Gross is possibly one of the players that maybe if we do start playing at a faster tempo, does he potentially get lost in it? I mean, I love Pascal and what he brings to the team, especially in terms of his delivery and his set piece is phenomenal. And I think you'd miss that kind of solid nature just behind the front two or three, depending how we're playing. But is there an opportunity there as well for someone like Mitoma? But I think Matoma's been phenomenal when he's been coming on. And you can't argue against him deserving a start. And I think he just needs to take that opportunity. I remember a few seasons ago when Trossard was starting to come into the team and he had come on as a sub, exactly the same questions were asked of him, saying, you know, he's doing well as a sub, but can he deliver it over 90 minutes? And I think the answer with hindsight and a couple of years on is a emphatic yes, he can. And he does it for the best international team in the world as well. So we're very fortunate with the squad that we've got at the moment.
And Peter, would you go along with that? Pascal Grosch, could he be a victim of not so much a cull of any sort, but just in terms of the subtle differences in the way we're set up and in some of the ways we might play slightly differently? Do you think people like Pascal could kind of fall victim for a while to that?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably, there's going to be people who benefit from the new manager and some who lose out. And, you know, someone like Lamptey and Mitoma, who are both very quick, might be ones who come in. And yeah, I mean, if you're talking about attacking with pace, it's much like, yeah, as Tom says, much like we all love Pascal. He's been brilliant for us. Maybe he's one who it's hard to see McAllister or Caicedo dropping out at any point soon, except one of them getting sold. So hard to see Trossard dropping out. I wonder the other one as well at some point, if it might be Welbeck. I mean, he's been brilliant this season, but how long can you carry on having a striker who has not scored a goal all season?
I would argue against that, though, because I don't think he's in the squad to score goals necessarily. And I think his ability to bring other players into those attacking positions creates more goals through that than what he could expect to score. So I think his kind of net contribution probably balances out. And I don't think we have anyone else in the squad that can quite play that position or create the chances that he can create. So yes, a few goals would be nice, and he should have scored at Liverpool with that header. But I think his kind of contribution to goals is probably more valuable to have him in the team for than to lose him.
Yeah, I think
I'm wondering more maybe if they try and sign someone in January. That's what I meant more. Yeah, I agree at the moment. And obviously, but they don't necessarily seem to favour Ndav. So, yeah, there isn't really anyone else now. And we tried playing Trossard up there against Fulham and it didn't really work. But yeah, I'm just wondering longer term maybe. And I agree with you generally. And I think it's just that he's missed like two or three now that he probably should have scored. And it's if they can find someone who can do the work that Welbeck does, but also score goals, then obviously. But yeah, whether that's too expensive, and you're getting into the realms of like, you know, 30, 40 million pounds, and it's obviously not money that we tend to spend. So
this is the thing. You'd have to have a Champions League budget to get that sort of a Champions League type player, which is what we're really describing there. Because I agree with Tom. I think, I mean, it sounds ridiculous. He's not in there to score goals, but it kind of is true. It's a subsidiary function of his position on the pitch, which seems an extraordinary thing, but I do think it's the case that he's mainly there to draw the space and to create more room for others. I think that was definitely what Graham Potter was trying to do with him earlier in the season, and I don't really see significant change under De Zerbi so far, but I do think in a sense, from the finishing point of view, I think he's going through an off-form phase. In terms of the general play, he isn't. And I think later in the season, he probably will go through a goal-scoring phase.
Where on Saturday, he actually did struggle a bit. He didn't really get any service, but when he did, the ball bounced off him quite a lot. And his first touch was quite heavy.
I think this happens when you're getting stifled by a team. It breaks your flow, breaks your confidence up a bit, though, doesn't it? I think everything can then get a bit staccatoed and a little bit fragmented, and you know, things don't quite run for you, and psychologically that affects just quite how you could address the ball or control it, just a small amount, but that small amount loses you a second maybe for the next ball. It's all contributory together, isn't it? I think in that regard it is a tough game, and I'm just looking forward to seeing how we do in the next two matches, and
four of the next six are all on paper. I know we were terrible against Villa both games last, or poor last year, but four of the next six before the World Cup are winnable. It'll be interesting to see what he does. Chelsea home even is potentially winnable, although they've done okay last few games with Potter there. Mm. City obviously isn't, but it is winnable, but it's a very unlikely one.
It's when you remember that it's the Albion, so we'll lose to Forest and beat City.
Yeah, that would be a classic Albion, wouldn't it? Completely awesome.
That they mean that Forest are better than City.
Yeah. They would claim it.
Yeah. A couple of very quick questions just for the match. On the goal itself, I mean, it was an instinctive finish from Kane, wasn't it? Just got his reactive head to the ball. Good finish.
Should have cleared the corner better, really.
I was going to say, defensively, you always say this when you're about goals conceded, but yeah, we could have done more with it. We haven't conceded too many from corners, but on this occasion, a bit disappointing. Would you go along with that, Tom?
Yeah, I think that the defensive line just didn't preempt the second ball coming in. I mean, if you look, we've all stepped up, and the Spurs players have kind of stayed in an offside position and waited for us to come back. So they're already kind of pushing that, and it was all just a bit too easy for it, and it's a frustrating goal to concede, and you know, every team will say, oh, it's a bad goal, but you know, Spurs are happy about it. Harry Kane scored yet again,
and he likes scoring against us, but he likes scoring in general, to be fair. The other things about just on the stats as well, interesting to note that we had apparently, I think it was 692 or 696, no, 694. It was in the middle. I knew it was somewhere there. 694 completed passes in this match, which is an extraordinary number. It's way over 100 more than normal, even when we've been on top of our game in the recent year or two. Also within that, midfielders, Caicedo, I think, had something like a 93% pass completion rate. I think McAllister had 88%. McAllister also had 104 completed passes. And I think also something like 130 something touches in the game as well. So, they were quite influential, despite the fact that the midfield overawed us, I think, probably further back. But would you say McAllister was man of the match? Because he looked it to me. I thought he was still... It's a hard one to call. You could argue Mittema for his contribution when coming on, which...
I'm not sure you can be for such a short time, can you?
Was it 30 minutes if you include...
I might have been inclined to go for Dunk or Veltman as well. I thought Denry did pretty well. McAllister potentially. So I think the stats from that are because we're trying to play it around at the back quite a lot to try and encourage Tottenham onto us, and also because Tottenham sat so deep, there was plenty of spaces around them.
Tom, who would you go for man of the match? It's a difficult one, this one, isn't it?
It's really, really tough. No one particularly stood out, to be honest. I think you could say any of March, Veltman, Dunk. To be fair, that the back line did all right. They retained possession well. They worked their well out. They worked their way out of tight spaces well. And I think you can see that the defence is the area that De Zerbi's had the most time with, especially with the international break, because that's the clearest difference so far. The amount of passes across the back has increased quite substantially, even in these two games. So I think it's not that surprising that we're passing more than we have been this season on average. And I think actually that triangle play between the centre-backs and McAllister, that probably is one of the contributing factors to the number of passes that they're completing.
And there was already quite a few complaints, should we say, in the MX on Saturday for De Zerbi's tactics, and people saying, get it forward. And there are, it's like, well, you need to get used to this. There are some things. I mean, I think McAllister came to the area with someone right up his back and Sanchez gave him the ball. And it was like, well, you don't want to do that because that's probably pushing it too far, giving too much of a risk. Sanchez had to get it. He just didn't have to give it straight back to Sanchez. There's playing it around and there's taking excessive risks. But I mean, the fact is we're going to be playing this way while De Zerbi is here. I don't see any way it's going to change. So just get used to it. It's a bit like when Poyet was here and people were moaning the first half.
I've got no problem with it at all. Bring it on.
It's going to be quite nervy at times, though. We are going to give away goals on it because it is quite, by definition, quite a kind of tight. If you want players to come in and pull them in, you've got to leave it quite late to pass the ball, and we are going to see goals with it.
Yeah, we will moan about that. It'll be more entertaining. I'm happy for him to follow his philosophy to the full, see how it goes. If it backfires badly, then fine, and he's gone. But if it doesn't, then we're going to see some great football. And I think a lot of people were very negative from stuff I've seen on social media, certain podcasts, certain other outlets that I've seen and heard things. I think they're much too much of a downer about it, to be honest. This was Spurs after all as well. It's not
the key is, I think, once we break the lines, we need to go with it, with the pace. And that's what I think. Obviously, Spurs were quite good at getting back anyway, and it won't necessarily be the same with Brentford and Forest.
Yeah.
But the key pace is we need to... Yeah. People will, if we start attacking with pace and having a go at teams in that situation, people will start to see the benefit, even if they're doubting it at first. I think the problem was Saturday. We didn't see the benefit of breaking the line because Spurs got back so quickly and we weren't quite at it in terms of the quick breaks that it sounded like we were at Liverpool. So you didn't really get the benefit of it, and people could just see the fact that we gave it away a few times. But hopefully the next couple of games, people will see the benefits as well.
It's quite nice hearing the... Falmer's favourite word being forward again in the stands always brings a wry smile, but I agree, people need to get used to it. And the one thing on my mind is that hopefully people do get behind it and it doesn't create that nervy atmosphere at home and we get to a position where it's easier to play away from home again like it was kind of last season and the season before. Because I think we've just turned a corner in terms of our home form and are much better at home now and seem to have that confidence going. And that feeds from the crowd as well. Whereas I think away from home, fans generally are more accepting of that style of play because you're watching it week in, week out. You don't have a month gap because of Premier League scheduling and whatnot between going to games. And I think it's the way forward. It's definitely exciting. It gets the adrenaline running when you're going, what the hell are you doing? But ultimately, exactly, there's more benefits to downfalls.
Yeah, and it's the buzz. It's the buzz fashion at the moment, isn't it, for playing this sort of way? And I do think it's going to reap some rewards, but we'll have to wait and see to what degree. But what you've said there about nervy attitudes and the crowd getting behind it segues nicely into my final point about Spurs. Well, a couple of points, actually, to do with the crowd situation. I wasn't there, so this is all from secondhand information I've heard. But I understand, first of all, that there were a number of issues with Spurs fans getting tickets in the home ends all over the place. I've heard reports of various kind of confrontational conversations in the north, in the east, and in the west.
Yeah, I mean, there might have been Spurs fans in the east in front of me, but to be fair, they didn't say anything. But they also didn't say anything in favour of the Albion either. And they also didn't join in Harry Kane baiting.
That last bit, Peter, I don't have an issue with, because if they're just sitting on their hands type of thing, then okay, fine. But if it's people, I was hearing multiple reports of people laughing in the face of the Albion fans as they were sort of like putting their hair out about, you know, in frustration of the game. Some people mocking, some openly celebrating, some did get kicked out. But there's, for example, a report of someone I know went with his wife and daughter in the 1901 club as a random one-off event. There were some Spurs fans in there who were just sort of like celebrating in the faces of Brighton fans, including him and his daughter. And when he kind of got a little bit tetchy, he eventually, the guy threatened to beat the shit out of him at half time. And why are people like that being allowed in there? I know away fans are allowed in the 1901 areas. I understand that, and that's fine. But you've got to behave respectfully, just as the same way as you're not allowed to wear tops. Fine, football tops. That's fine. You know, just follow the rules. If you're going to sit in a home end as an away fan, the club will have, but I won't have a particular objection with that per se. But you have to behave respectfully. And it sounded as if, and I'm not surprised to hear this, knowing what Spurs are like, a sizable number, probably the majority of those, well, it's hard to tell because we won't notice the ones that have been respectful, but a sizable number of Spurs fans were behaving inappropriately. And this has come about, I assume, because the ticket exchange went down to the sort of levels where people who just live locally or even fairly locally can register as members and then get, you know, final priority level tickets. Because, of course, the problem was the train strike. Shitloads of people couldn't make the game, and as such, shitloads of tickets went on the ticket exchange. So, I mean, Tom, you were nodding away there about all the incidents that you hear about. You're in the north stand, and we've got one.
I'm not actually. I'm in the east upper. But
you're in the north. All right.
No. I know a lot of them in the north, and I'm involved with NSK and support them. But I chose a little bit of luxury, I suppose. For home games, so sitting the East Upper, but there was a Spurs fan that enjoyed the Harry Kane goal, I'll say, behind me. So he jumped up, had a cheer, and then very quickly realised that he shouldn't have done that and sat down and was on his hands for the rest of the game. Because I think if he had said something else, people would have probably told him to leave.
I said, it's going to depend. I'm sure we'll hear more and more about this later on. But yeah, incidents I've heard about was a punch up in the West Upper. I haven't had that substantiated, that sort of secondhand info. But apparently there was a punch up or a set to between two or three people.
Are you just annoyed that for once you didn't start it?
Exactly. Yeah. I just wish I bloody West Upper. I could have been involved in that.
Taking over my turf.
it just is frustrating that. Tickets being sold to away fans, tickets being sold to whoever. You can bring guests under your name for these games, and you know, at home games, there's kind of this crazy Western-like attitude towards tickets, and then you've got all the away fans being vilified because a couple of people have been kicked out that shouldn't have had a ticket, and it just makes a mockery of the whole situation for fans, really, when there's such a difference between the way home tickets are treated and away tickets are treated. Also, it's crazy, and I think we'll probably talk about that a bit more. But
yeah, we'll get onto this a bit more in part two, because I'm going to have a rant about away tickets and various other bits on that score. The only other thing I was going to mention with the Spurs, apart from that issue with the away fans and home fans, was in terms of the numbers, I couldn't really substantiate how many people were there. It looked like it wasn't that empty in terms of
numbers. It was more full than I thought it would be, actually, given the fact that, they're all in transport.
Yeah, they're all in Tottenham tops, yeah. No, well, it's hard to know, isn't it, how many of those were Spurs fans. But, it seemed
they
like...
They still get there, even if they were Spurs fans. I mean...
Well, exactly.
I was surprised it was as full as it was.
Yeah, I guess there's loads of Spurs fans live locally because they don't want to live in Tottenham, that's for sure. Anyway, that'll probably sum that up for that. What about the atmosphere as well, actually, Tom and Pete? What was it like? Because obviously we started badly and then went behind. So
yeah, I thought pre-match in the first 10 minutes it was good, but then I think the Spurs took control. It kind of quietened and went into, and there was a lot of nerves around the kind of the way we were playing, to the point where I think at one point Dunkey was kind of like trying to encourage the fans to get behind it, behind it generally. So I think, it wasn't a game that inspired a good atmosphere, if I'm honest. Mm. There wasn't much that happened to get people off their seats, to get people, cheering. It was a reason it was last on Match of the Day. Yeah. It was pretty boring.
Right? Yeah, I think it was a typical Falmer atmosphere, where I think unfortunately the atmosphere just thrives off of what's happening on the pitch, and when it's fast, when it's lots of action on the pitch, the atmosphere ramps up and ramps up, and you can feel that energy kind of build, and I think that's one thing that we need to get better as home fans, is actually that get behind, sing songs, support the team in a positive way regardless of what's happening on the pitch. We feed too much off of what that performance is like. Whereas at Liverpool, for example, the atmosphere was incredible for 20 minutes. It dipped a little bit after they scored a couple of goals, but then picks back up because you get the feeling that we need to do this. Yeah. And I think that's the same energy that needs to come into home games a bit more. I think we've been getting better. Like the Leicester atmosphere was brilliant, but again, that's because the performance was good, and that's where we need to come. I'd also say though, I thought, bar the first part of the game where Spurs were on top, their fans were quite quiet as well. So there's not even the energy to feed off between the fans. It was the right atmosphere for the game, because it was just nothing all round, really.
Yeah. Well, on that note, and we will talk about, the North Stand collective in part two as well. We'll break for a half time there. And when we come back, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about away ticketing and a quick preview of the Brentford game as well. So stay tuned. So welcome back to part two. I'm with Peter and Tom. Hylands is with us as well. Welcome back, guys. And, part two, we're going to talk a little bit more about not so much of the atmosphere at home games in general, because we've just done that, but in terms of the NSK. So, Tom, you're a member of NSK, if that's the right expression, part of the collective, the Ultras group, which is situated in the North Stand. As you've just established in part one, you're actually in the East Upper, so you're not actually with them on home match days. But essentially, they're based in that area. Tell us more about that. Are you a member? Is that the right expression?
Yeah. So,
physical membership?
Member and just supportive of them. I think, all ultras can have a bad name, especially if you look at ultras groups on the continent. I think the connotations are quite often right-wing violence and kind of a lot of negativity around attitude. But I think with NSK, the thing that I notice and knowing them, they're some of the nicest people you ever meet, and that the driving factor with the NSK is looking at how we can improve the atmosphere and support for the Albion, and also raising awareness around things like equality in football and football for all, and some of those kind of real important topics. So, you know, challenging sexism, challenging racism, challenging homophobia, the things that blight the game. You know, I think one of the driving factors is we want people to feel like they can come to a game, whoever they are. We want players to feel like they have our support regardless, and want to just improve that experience, really. So I think that's kind of where it comes from. And I think where I got involved was, I met them on a pre-season tour in Geneva, of all places. Just out there as a, I think there's about 200 or 300 Albion fans. So you get talking to people, started talking to some of the guys there. And then you just start seeing them at away games. And I think the atmosphere that they can create is good. I think it's always been kind of noted by players that corner of the North Stand tends to be quite noisy. And I think, you know, it's trying to spread that. And the North Stand at Falmer is notoriously difficult to get one united song across the whole stand, because it's hard to hear what the other side is doing.
This is the problem, isn't it? Because there's another faction pretty much under the scoreboard over towards the east side of the north. And yeah, I've been in the north on a number of occasions in the past, not for a while, but when you're in one of those areas, you can't really hear you can hear something's going on, but you've got no way of picking up what exactly it is. And it's not logistically possible. You need to have basically a deeper stand, and then have people positioned in certain places within that stand for it to work. You've got the northwest kind of slightly further round. There's people have joined in. I've noticed there's kind of like another pocket of people just next to where the ultras themselves are. I don't know if they're also now ultras. I don't know, but it seems to be spreading a little. You've got the southwest as well, where people try to make a bit of noise, and the west upper does as well. But in terms of this organisation of songs, you know, they're the driving force of most of the new stuff that comes out, aren't they, in one form or another, whether it be inventing it or you know, pushing it to being popular once heard. And I know a few of those guys that you've mentioned, including obviously yourself, Big Dan, Tall Dan, I should say. I know, and I've met Annie a fair few times, so I know them. But it seemed a good bunch. Every time I've chatted with any of them, good bunch of people. What could they do? What could be done more in terms of the atmosphere? Obviously, safe standing and repositioning of fans. Was that the way forward? Would people want that?
Yeah, so I know that, you know, obviously we'd love to see safe standing come in, but the club seemed quite anti that in a lot of the conversations that there's been had, and there doesn't seem to be the desire from the wider Albion fan base either. To a certain extent, how true that is, I don't really know, because I don't think we've ever really been given a chance to really put forward our views on that in a proper way. I think you could look at trying to create a singing section like we had at Withdean, like so many other clubs have. I mean, Huddersfield stand out as a club that had a phenomenal atmosphere at Premier League games, because they had a massive singing section directly next to the away fans.
No coincidence how that works, has it?
I know, and it's things like that. But again, you know, I don't think the club will ever look at that all the time, that we are selling out games all the time, that season tickets are near sellout, because it means displacing people and moving people against their will. And I don't think the club's ever going to really look at that. Other things that you could do is, and a contentious one amongst Albion fans, is look at things like a drum. I think if you look at after games, we've had songs going for an hour after the game because someone's banging on a bin. And it can help keep that timing, keep that kind of atmosphere go in and provide a segue into other songs, other ways. I mean, I think we just need to listen more as well and pick up what songs are starting to take off and join in those. But that can be difficult to do. But there's all sorts of things that could be looked at. But I think anyone or any group that is wanting to try and improve the atmosphere at Falma is a real positive. And I think any efforts should be tried. But, you know, I know you said about songs. The songs generally take off at away games first, yeah, when you're packed in, because that's the easiest way to spread them. In the pubs beforehand, at those games, and then try and get it back to the home games.
Trains and stations, of course, as well. Although, in actual fact, that bit can work for home games, of course, as well, the trains and stations. In fact, when I first picked up the Pride of the South Coast one, when it came out, I heard that at the station with, I noticed Dan and Annie and that lot were all strolling along, driving that along, just pushing it, sort of on repeat for a bit, just to try and get it in people's heads. One thing, songs that take off, especially newer ones, things that haven't been listened to here, and I'm loath to mention You Know Who, but they've kind of tapped into, they've got an ultra section as well, you know, the They Who Must Not Be Named lot, but they've tapped into things like Argentinian ultra songs, I noticed. None of their stuff's original either, but it's going down a different line. So, I mean, that could be one way in, but if you've got a completely different tune, you have to kind of keep pushing it till it gets in people's heads. You know, just like any song released in the charts, you know, it's not catchy until you've heard it a couple of times and then start to get addicted to it.
It's also simplicity and the ability for it to keep going. So if you look at kind of songs that have done well over the last few years, you've got the Basuma Tequila song, which apparently is created by Arsenal fans, if you believe.
I noticed they'd invented that one.
They've invented that one despite us singing it for the last three seasons. But that's a tune that hadn't really been done on the stands in the league before that.
Yeah, surprisingly, actually.
Yeah, you've also got Caicedo's song that has taken off well. Mm. But again, it's not a common song to be used on the terrace in terms of the original. So those songs that people know the rhythm to, that it's easy to understand and fun to sing and can be repeated for 45 minutes like it was after the Man United game last season. I think they're the ones that do best, because you need to make it accessible for people that are in the West Stand and the East Stand, because ultimately, to make the most noise in the stadium, you need others to get involved.
Yeah, that's it. Southampton away last season with Morpay's equaliser. That was ridiculous. The volume and the longevity of the Morpay song after that game was truly ridiculous. That was great. My throat was in a mess after that.
The same with Gross against Man United on the first day of the season this year. Sometimes it just takes a moment from a player for something to stick as well. So you can have a song, and we've been trying for five seasons to get a song for Gross, and then one that just really was on no one's radar suddenly takes off at Man United when he scores a brace. I mean, but that's part of football. The spontaneity of the crowd can be what makes it.
Yeah. Someone could just think of something on the spot, shout it out, a few people nearby think it's funny and good, and then on it goes.
I think there's one element, though, that I think we have to be careful of. And I think there's a rise in almost negative songs and songs that are kind of casually sexist or casually kind of misogynistic. Mm. And I think, you know, it would be nice for us to steer away from that, because one, they're easy, but two, they don't stand for the values that we do as a city or a club. And actually, we don't want to go down that road.
Agreed. The other issue, completely a much less serious level, is the rate of singing is ridiculous, isn't it? I don't know why. I think it's because I don't think as a city we're sort of known particularly for singers as such. I know there's a number of bands come from Brighton and everything else, but in terms of, I don't know, if you look at, say, places that have got well known for their songs, like Liverpool, it's a city full of people that will sit around in pubs singing, having sing songs. A bit like in Ireland, it's kind of the Irish heritage thing.
Yeah.
And I think if you've got more natural, if you are actually a good singer, that helps, obviously. And if there's enough good singers, that will make the general standard be higher. I'm wondering if that's our issue. We just seem to sing things out of tune too fast.
It's just a timing issue. No one knows how to keep time or keep a consistent speed. And that's where a drum would actually help, because it would keep people on time.
I'm gonna say I'm kind of ambivalent about a drum. On the one hand, everything about me goes, no, tin pot, blah, 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 all the other stuff. On the other hand, as you said, I've been at away games. In fact, I've been doing it myself at away games on a number of occasions. And you mentioned banging a bin, actually, at Falmer. I did that once for quite a long time. I think it might have been after the Wigan game. I can't remember now, that you were talking about earlier. But, you know, whacking the back of the corrugated iron at Brentford's old ground, or, you know, some other places that we've been to since. That kind of percussiveness does kind of keep the song in time. So the other side of it is, well, you know, we are so bad with keeping the pace of a song right, maybe we can't be too precious.
It's just finding a drummer that can keep time as well. With all of these, it's about trying things to improve the atmosphere. I think, you know, the more that we can try, the more that we can do, the better. You know, people might not have liked the design of the flag on Saturday, for example, but at least they're doing something. At least people are doing something and wanting to try and bring something new to match day. Yeah. And if they can get a process where that can become more common and other designs can be done and other things can be done to help add to the match day experience and the atmosphere, then that can only be a positive.
Absolutely. I was just going to come onto that subject, actually, the banner, the flag. It's been designed to welcome De Zerbi for his first home game. Made it in time, a bit of crowdfunding involved. As I understand it, it was 12x9. It was expanded to a 15x12 ratio with a bit of input from the club. They actually donated towards it to allow it to be a bit bigger, and I think it needed to be a bit bigger. There's, of course, the feedback is it should have been even bigger.
Yeah.
But the point is, I think your point is right, though. It's not about, right, that's the flag, that's it now, and if you don't like the design, you're just gonna have to moan about it every week. It's not about that. This was an initiative just to get the concept of getting flags into the ground properly again, apart from the ones at the back of the north, and that's one initiative. The club were quite accommodating of it in terms of the concept of it, allowing it, but also putting some money in towards it. It was Clive with Fab, actually, the Fan Advisory Board, who's also now a member of Sequels Over London. And it was his initiative, but he didn't want it to be just about him, and he wouldn't want me to say it was. But it was about, look, let's get something going. I'll put my money in. Anyone else interested? And then, you know, if enough people contribute, all you need to do is once in a while have a flag, make a new one, have more than one, have several. If you don't like the De Zerbi one, great, let's get another one. Let's get something else on. Get something that's less sort of manager-centric. Maybe get one that's about Sussex, get another one that's about Brighton the club, one about Brighton the city, Brighton and Hove the city, you know, fine. Just chuck loads of stuff in. Have one about Pascal Gross, to go along with the song. It's about...
The fun part is... how the club look after it. So I organised the Wembley flag.
Yes.
Yeah. So I arranged that with the club, sorted the design and worked with the club to get that done. And we're now, are we 4 years down the road?
Yeah.
Nearly?
Yeah. Three and a half, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think about 6 months after the club said it was still at Wembley, then somehow come back from Wembley, but no one knows where it is.
Yeah.
So you can file it under the Albion Mysteries.
Yes.
You know.
We had the other flag, didn't we? The one at Whitby, which got lost. And ultimately, I think it got a bit worse for wear. It was very heavy. I think heavier than it might have been for its size. And it was lugged around by usually about six people. And I think the wear and tear just by having to carry something like that around, not only is a huge it's a huge burden for people to carry, but also it was just getting in a state. And I think it was left out. And by all accounts, it was then either mistaken for or presumed to be rubbish to be thrown away. And that was lost, that one. But, you know, the point is, at home games, a bit like when I've gone to Germany and I've seen ultra culture in Germany, and they've got cupboards and storage space, and all of the ultras come in, they've got a key for the cupboard, unlock it, get all the stuff out. Now, by all accounts, this flag is being stored at the club in a cupboard, according to
Clark. that doesn't necessarily mean it stays there. We've had that issue as well.
Oh no, really? Well, if the club can actually stay on tune here and keep that organised properly and allow those things to be stored safely and securely and continuously so, then you can have a real atmosphere. If you see what Saudi FC have done, they've got loads of flags everywhere now pre-match. And then obviously, same with Liverpool, same with all the other clubs that bang out loads of visuals. It gets taken away and put somewhere. You don't plonk it down by your feet. So it's
pre-match at Anfield, it's the same. There's so many flags, there's displays, but you don't want to become like Liverpool, have a great display beforehand, sing Sussex by the Sea, and then be quiet for the 90 minutes.
No.
So,
it shouldn't be kill and end all. No, yeah, the vocals are the most important bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, agreed. Right. Okay. Well, moving swiftly on then. Anything else in terms of like general news? We'll come to a rant about tickets in a minute, but general news, just quickly fire through a few things. With the economics and the energy crisis as it is, Mansfield have been trialling 1 p.m. kickoffs to avoid the floodlight costs. Whether or not that would be negated by the number of people who then can't arrive so early due to work commitments or travel commitments or whatever else, who knows? But it's an interesting experiment. There's did you hear about the 10-metre controversy at the Ajax v Arsenal women's game a couple of weeks ago? The goalposts, you know, there's a thing about, oh, we should have the goalposts smaller. Well, they actually did have the goalposts smaller. That caused a bit of controversy there. Interesting item on the agenda there. Erling Haaland scored again. That's not really news at all, is it? Anything else?
I think it's news that he didn't score tonight because he didn't play for City. They only drew at Copenhagen.
Oh, really? That's the Champions League as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so just finished 1-0. And yeah, Haaland didn't score, but he also didn't play as well. He was on the bench, so...
Yeah, that's a fairly good excuse for not scoring, but...
Would say, but I mean, if he was really committed, he'd have probably scored anyway.
Yeah. All you needed to do, really, you just got to play him for 25 minutes each game, haven't you? That'll do the job. Anyway, any other bits...
I'm sure they won't, but I wish they would rest him against us as well.
I think just to raise that, you know, it's another week with international football at Falmer with the Lionesses again. And I think, you know, it's great that Brighton is being used and now it's kind of part of the folklore of women's football. And I hope that actually we can translate that into some of the support for the Albion women's team. I know that season tickets are kind of through the roof, even though I haven't received mine yet in the post. I think it's great to see the women's game being given that positive kind of like, what, there were 77,000 people at Wembley on Friday to watch them beat the USA. I mean, it's brilliant. It's a very different atmosphere, but it's a real positive environment.
Brilliant crowd, brilliant result there. But you're right about the folklore thing, because, of course, the Amex's first kind of general folklore outside of the Albion men's team was obviously that Rugby World Cup with the Japan thing, when loads of Japanese tourists started coming over. You know, Paul Barber and Paul Cameron were saying they were inundated with a load of inquiries and all that sort of thing. So that's one embedded folklore that will be there forever. But what we didn't have was something non-Albion related that was football related. And, of course, we had that with the Euros. With the women's team having that, well, those two games, phenomenal. One record-breaking scoreline and one come-from-behind victory against a really good Spain team. And both superb events that will indelibly link that England team, who were the first to win a major tournament in, what was it, 55 years, isn't it? 56 years. That's going to be there forever now. And if we can reinforce that folklore. Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely agree. Yeah. So anything else, Peter? Any other general football news?
I suppose is what we probably need to.
Yeah, I was going to come on to that next. Yeah, let's talk about that next. So, yeah, we've unfortunately not a good week for the Albion, losing the game with Spurs. But also, yeah, the sad news, I think it was yesterday, Monday, where it was announced that Enoch Mwepu has had to retire from the game. Senior men's player for us at the moment. He's been on international duty, but didn't actually get to play. I think he was pretty much taken ill with something related to the condition as soon as he was over there with his team, Zambia. He was in hospital. We haven't really heard anything since other than just having it described as illness until yesterday when it was announced it's a heart-related condition. The club put out an announcement. Enoch did himself on social media. And unfortunately, at the age of 24, a really promising young player, a joyful, nice guy by the looks of it and everything I've seen. Seen or heard from him. Such a tragedy, isn't it?
I think that's the biggest thing. Every time he was interviewed, every time he played with a smile on his face and he just exuded that positivity and I think would have been a well-liked member of the squad. He was a talented, talented player. I mean, the goals he scored were brilliant. The chances he created. And it's just, I think the biggest shame is that we won't ever get to see him in his prime. And that's what's been cut. And, you know, you've also got to remember that it's someone losing their career and how devastating it must be for him to have kind of made it to the promised land of the Premier League and then a year on having to retire completely. I just hope that, you know, the club are supportive of him, which no doubt they will be, and whether there's a potential for him to do some of his coaching badges with us and to support him in that way as well, so that it's not such a big hit to him. And I think most people would be quite receptive of that if we did that.
Yeah,
I agree. I think also, I really like the way the message he put out yesterday as well. It was so positive. It was like, you know, I dreamed of playing the Premier League and I achieved that dream thanks to Brighton and the fans and all that sort of thing and all the clubs I played for. And it was a really positive message, but he must be gutted. I mean, it's in that Leicester game, he was superb. And, you know, obviously including assist as well. Goal of the season last year. We're going to miss him a lot. I was really hoping he had a bit of an injury hit the season last year where he's out in and out a bit. I was really hoping he'd be one who went and built on it the next season and showed, you know, he was a regular in the team this year. And yeah, it's gutting for him that he's you know, just happened.
The one positive, I think, though, is that it's been found now and that we weren't facing a situation like there was with Ericsson, for example, and him collapsing on the pitch. I think that's something that you have to be grateful for. Yeah. And yes, we've lost a good player in our squad, but ultimately there's some things that are more important than that.
Absolutely. And it must be a very serious condition because, you know, you look at like Goldson, you look at like Eriksen, both have come back and played at very high, you know, high levels. So for him to have to just straight away, they've not even, you know, they've just done an investigation and within a month he's retired or a few weeks he's retired. So it must be really serious and it would have been something that obviously, could have come at any time. So, as you say, it's like football is obviously very important to a lot of people, but it's, health is much more important to everyone, And it's just a real shame for him and for the club because he looked a player who could genuinely make a big difference for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And, it was a lovely message you put out. It clearly was a more serious version of his condition than others have had with theirs, and you just can't take any chances. I'm sure the decision wasn't taken lightly either. They would have explored every avenue, whether if there was any avenues, and then just made the decision from there. But it's a shame, and a bit unlucky for the Albion because we've had this with Connor Goldson, and then obviously we've had it with Mwepu. We were going to sign a player from somewhere on the continent, weren't we, a year or two ago, and he had a heart issue. So I hope this isn't going to be an ongoing association with the club. Although if it's
it obviously shows how hard it was to spot this one because Tuamino, they spotted, and then he went somewhere else, and then they found that he had to retire, I think, didn't they? It didn't even seem afterwards. So it shows how hard it was to spot this one that the club didn't pick it up, because they've got a good record of picking up that sort of thing.
Yeah. But I'm so glad he played so well in his final game, that Leicester game before, obviously, the international break came in, and then he played his last game.
Yeah, it wasn't Fulham away, which he looked a bit lost in, because he was out of position, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's true.
Really good that his last game was that one, agreed. Yeah.
And Tom?
Yeah, I just think that, again, testament to our medical team as well, because I think they have such a good track record on picking those up, and it does sound like this was picked up at the earliest opportunity, because I know Adam Brett, the head of medical, said that there was no signs of it in the medical, because they did all the tests and the same tests were now showing it. So I think we're very lucky that we have the ability to pick these up, both from a kind of point of view of as a club in terms of taking risks, but also for those players. They know that they will get the best treatment and the best kind of professionals looking after them here.
Yeah, it's good. It's another positive for the Albion in terms of, as you said, just showing that we're looking after players and we will treat them correctly, and we will do our very best to discover any issues. There's lots of positives that could be said about the Albion, and they've handled this very well, and thumbs up to them, and especially to Enoch, who, for taking it in seemingly good grace. And he said he had the dream to play, and he did get to play. He's got that, at least. He's made senior football, he's made the Premier League, he's had some happy times already. That we cannot, of course, forget that goal at Liverpool. There you go, what a great goal that was. I don't care if the sun's in Alisson's eyes or not, what a cracker.
And also the one at Arsenal as well was brilliant.
Well, that was brilliant, wasn't it? Yeah. And it came obviously in the middle of a peak period for us for wins in North London, which was wonderful. He goes with our best wishes for whatever he gets up to. He wants to stay in the game. We'll see what that involves particularly. I know the poet Zombies pretty gutted as well. He was tweeting about it, wasn't he? If anyone doesn't know who he is, just Google it. another Zambian national. It's a shame, but we wish him the best. Football. Let's get back to the next game, Brentford away, Friday night. We did well there last year. Well, we didn't play amazingly well, but we did get the result. Are we going to do it again this season? I don't know, it's a tough one, isn't it? We've got, in terms of the head-to-head, the overall historical head-to-head, we've won 34, we've drawn 14, and we've lost 28. So fairly even, but we've got the edge. I know, obviously, you're not going, Tom, because you're going to be in Iceland. Maybe up an iceberg with a flag, hopefully, to celebrate if we win. Peter, you're going, I'm going.
I am going, yeah. I think missed it last year. I definitely wouldn't miss it, yeah.
Yeah, first thing to say, good set of fans, really lovely bunch of people from the ones I've met anyway. They've got a good podcast as well called Besotted with Billy Grant, who we've had on before in the past. So I recommend that if you want to get the opposition view. Our views though on the game, are we going to bounce back from the Spurs game? What kind of score, what sort of performances do you expect from the players? Who's going to be in the starting 11? What do we think? Should we go to you, Peter, first?
It's a tough one, isn't it? He'll probably need to give one or two with three games in, 8 to 9 days, whatever sort of thing. He'll probably need to try and switch it around a bit at times. Mitoma's probably the obvious one. I would have said Mepu probably if it had been, obviously enough, if it hadn't been for the announcement this week. Is Lallana fit to start one of the games against Forest or Brentford, an obvious one as well? Or Lamptey? I don't know. It felt like Osasco maybe needed to fresh up a little bit, because it is surprising, considering at one point under Potter we seemed to change about three or four of our players every game. We've had 13 starters this year, and that's all. We were saying about the least used players, but I think it's 13 starters. The team that started at the weekend, and Wepu and Lallana, are the only ones who've started games this season, which is very small number. So, maybe one or two slight changes. Brentford aren't on great form. They got stuffed by Newcastle at the weekend, so
yeah,
it's not exactly,
don't know if that's good or bad, really.
Just, but my negativity in my mind goes, oh, well, probably means they'll stuff us now or something. I've not got over those 2-4-0 defeats in a row there over in the early 2000s.
And Newcastle annoyingly going well. Was it 4-1 at Fulham, 5-1 against
Brentford? Yeah, I mean, Fulham was down to 10, playing 10 men for 85 minutes, wasn't it, or something?
True. They're ahead of us annoyingly now. But anyway, I think it's a really hard one to call. I haven't really got an idea of how this game's going to go other than to lazily say, oh, it might be a draw in this one. I want, as I said earlier in the pod, I want 4 points out of these two games because we've got some toughies coming up here and there. And I want to keep some momentum going. And I think, obviously, Roberto hasn't had a win yet, despite an excellent performance against Liverpool and probably deserving a goalless draw against Spurs, in my opinion. But in this game, yeah, we've got to try and grab the win. We don't want to put too much pressure on the Forest match. But if, say, for example, we lost to Brentford, suddenly there's a bit of a rut potentially developing. 4 points out of...
Around the same time we had the rut last year as well, the first
exactly. Yeah, after the same sort of start, yeah. I've got a feeling this is going to be a draw. I want the win, but I think I'll go for a 2-2 draw in this one, I think. There's going to be goals in it. I don't think we'll keep them out completely, but I think we'll get back on track to some degree. I think we'll be able to get in behind them a little bit more than we were with Tottenham. But anything is possible in this match. Brentford are a bit unpredictable for me at the moment, I think.
I think that's the key. They've been inconsistent. I think they smashed Leeds a few weeks ago, got smashed by Newcastle. But I think that the way that they'll come out and play and attack does potentially favour us in the game. I think we'll be facing a situation more like Liverpool where there's a space in behind for us to exploit and we'll be able to play quicker, I think, and have more space to play in their half on the turnovers at least. So I think, you know, if we can start quick, I think if we can get that tempo back in, which I don't see any reason why not, I think we can come away with 3 points. But equally, as with every away game, I'd take a point.
Yeah. One person that's going to be in the away end, of course, is Tony Bloom. He doesn't go in the VIP areas for this match. He was at Seagulls Over London this week, by the way. One of the very rare occasions I've had to miss a meeting because I was still coming back from Italy. It's a bit of a hell of an annoying one to miss, but by all accounts, a very good evening was had by all. He's going to be in the away, and we might see him.
Very interesting, as always.
Yeah. I hope he's not coming in on anyone else's ticket. That's all I can say, though. Peter, you're going as whose ticket have you got?
I don't know yet. I've got about 3 or 4 different identities to kind of come up with so far. So I need to decide which one's the most realistic and which of my fake IDs works best.
And then get coked up on the train and start fighting and get kicked out. Yeah, that seems to be the modus operandi.
I mean, I do that anyway, whoever I am, to be honest.
We are moving on to our final subject. As you can probably tell, it's about the away ticket stuff. Now, we've had various issues to do with sharing tickets here and there in the Albion in general. A few weeks ago, towards the end of September, it was announced that there was going to be a clampdown on away ticket sharing, which technically shouldn't be happening at all. The issue seems to be centred around a number of dickheads who weren't on their own ticket, causing problems, getting arrested or at least kicked out of away grounds. Obviously, that drew attention to the club. And also, there's been a lot of touting around of tickets that couldn't be used by people that have bought them. Or either couldn't be used or they never intended to.
Or asking for them as well, similarly.
Asking for them as well, yeah, exactly, which was on social media, again, noticed by the club. Stupidity from any of those people concerned is the first thing to say. If you don't know somebody, you shouldn't be giving or buying tickets from them anyway. That's my opinion on that. However, I have objections with the system that's been imposed. Essentially, they're doing spot checks ad hoc, which... in itself shouldn't be an issue if you've got your own ticket. I've got two issues. One of them, the club will say, isn't an issue because you shouldn't be exchanging tickets. But you could buy tickets in good faith. You could, due to a number of different reasons, not be able to go to a match. Suddenly you've got to work, or there's an illness in the family, or you're ill, or you've got COVID, or trains have cancelled, there's a train strike. Various, you know, you can list loads of reasons why you might suddenly not be able to go after you bought the ticket. Now, obviously, that if you've got a ticket exchange system for the way, that's one way of doing things. But if you wanted to give your ticket to someone you can trust who is trustworthy, is that really a problem? Probably not. And that isn't really the target of the club's new policy. But that is what who's going to get caught out if people still did it.
I agree. There's two elements for me. There's that. And I think, you know, we're in a cost of living crisis here. So yeah. You're saying to people, you've got to upfront your £31 for the ticket. If you can't go, you have to lose that £31 because there is no right way or legal way or whatever to return the ticket and get a refund. Yeah. So that seems tone deaf at best. The second is the insistence on photo ID, because not everyone has photo ID.
Yeah.
So you are discriminating, and it, you know, a lot of time it can be people that are on the lower side of income that don't have photo ID.
They so don't drive and they don't go.
Discriminatory policy.
Yeah, if you don't drive and you don't go abroad, as you said, that's likely to be describing someone of a lower income as often as not. Exactly. That's a very good point. And my other issue with it is the inconvenience that's going to be caused. So I emailed Paul Barber. Paul Barber forwarded my email on to Jenny Gower, head of supporter services, at the time this was announced. The email, by the way, I'll just try and catch where I've got it. Without going into too much detail, the email essentially came from the club originally, said that they, basically had a load of incidents. And they said, we are therefore advising all supporters in line with our terms and conditions that there will be ad hoc ID checks, starting with our fixture at Brentford. Away tickets will have names and fan numbers written on them, and some tickets will at random be retained and held for collection at away grounds with matching photo ID required for entry, which is essentially what we've just been saying. But so that's what the club said specifically. I sought some clarification because what it didn't say was where you're going to be getting these tickets from. And essentially Jenny's reply, perfectly reasonable reply, she said she'd just like to provide some context as to why we're putting in ad hoc checks. Then she goes on to mention all the incidents that have been happening. She then says, more and more we're seeing tickets being distributed on message boards and social media, et cetera, et cetera. Again, you know, fair point there. Then she says, with smaller allocations for Fulham, Bournemouth and Brentford, we've seen tickets sell out to top bracket loyalty points holders and not getting as far as all season ticket holders. This has caused complaints with supporters who have missed out, but seen tickets then being distributed unofficially on social media. So queue jumping elements, you can see their point. That's
However, if you're a 1901 club, you're exempt from that and you can transfer it.
Exactly.
So what they're saying is you can only do this if you pay enough money to us.
So it sounds like the club have turned into the Tory government. Yeah. There's one rule for the rich, one rule for the poor.
The other thing is, how prevalent is it actually? And realistically, is it going to change the chance for the people in the next tier down to get a ticket? Because if there's, say, 100 tickets passed, that's only 100 tickets that are going to be available in that next tier, and they'll be snapped up as soon as they go on sale.
Yeah.
So yes, you can say that obviously it gives them a chance, but equally we're talking about such small numbers here, and at the same time the only games that it's a problem at is Fulham, Brentford, Bournemouth, that have smaller allocations. Because Wolves you can still buy an away ticket for,
it's also not
City,
gonna work
you can
as
still
well.
Buy an away ticket for Arsenal in the cup, they're actively encouraging you to bring friends that they have no idea who it is. You could bring someone that was banned because they're not checking who's buying tickets.
And the system's also not going to work because it's not going to stop. It's going to stop people maybe buying in advance for other people, but what it won't stop is the people touting their ticket online, because they've actually told people who are for each game who are going to be people who need to pick up their ticket have been emailed and not sent their tickets. So once you've been sent your ticket, you know that you're not going to get an ID check from what I can get.
No, you might still get an ID check.
I hadn't picked that one up.
All you need to do now is just, if you were going to sell your ticket to someone else and you've been told it's going to be checked, you just don't turn up. And if they say, why didn't you turn up? You'll just say, well, I was ill, or the train strike, or whatever it is. So you're not going to catch those people. You're just going to cause them the inconvenience, not be able to do what they wanted to do. But meantime, the people that aren't getting checked, who might still be blazing and try it, and now know that they're not going to get checked, they'll go for it, because they'll think, right, let's take a chance on the ticket price, see if we get emailed. Now they're not going to get emailed, then you know, they go, great, well, we can do this now. I mean, perhaps most sensible people wouldn't want to risk it, but there were the sort of dickheads that get themselves kicked out of great games will risk it.
And you can always just say you've lost your ID or whatever, and then the worst they'll do is just say, well, you can't go in.
Yeah.
So they won't know that you're not the right person. Yeah. You can just say...
Just to say the rest of the email, she said, our intention is not to cause inconvenience and we will try to minimise disruption to supporters. At the Brentford game, we have a dedicated collection point, which is separate to Brentford's ticket office and will be staffed by members of the Albion Supporter Services team. We will select a small random number, which obviously has already happened, et cetera, et cetera. She said, we will do this for a manageable number of tickets to try to minimise queues. But she then goes on to say something, I can't find where it is now, but... something about, oh, here we are. Arrangements will vary by game depending on sales and facilities that are available. And this is where my issue is. My match day, you were saying earlier about, Tom, about socialising is a big part of the day. If I'm going to an away game, I do not want to be inconvenienced at all on any occasion by having to break away from friends earlier, go to the ground a bit earlier than they do, try and find a ticket point, which might be the normal ticket collection point, wherever it is, at a ground I'm not familiar with in that respect, only in terms of where the away end is. And then maybe there's some kind of system crash happens and you've got a whole load of home fans with issues to sort out and you're queued behind them. You know, are they going to have staff available to do a separate queue for us? No, they're not. I don't want that inconvenience. It's irritating. It's already annoying enough that you're not sure if you can go to the game because the TV schedules change the
train
day.
Strikes.
A train strike suddenly get imposed, which is what happened to all the people that wanted to go to Liverpool, yeah. Some of whom couldn't go.
My dad didn't go to the game at Liverpool because
he didn't
want to drive on his own. And if he
gave his ticket to someone else and they got caught using it and he was a responsible adult, your dad gets, what is it, a 10-match ban?
Yeah. Just to clarify, he didn't do that as well. His seat was just unused, which apparently is what the club wants. Apparently the club want that to happen. So they want the empty seats in the away end. They don't want actual supporters to see games. And it feels more and more like we're being treated as a whole thing that Paul Barber once said about being customers rather than supporters.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we're not, because a customer, if they didn't like it, would walk off and support and go somewhere else. But none of us are going to do that. Yeah. Yes, there might be a few fair weather people who might.
We're exploiting our necessity to carry on supporting this club, not to move. I think you might be buffering a bit there, Tom. I don't know if you
can... Yeah, I think this is where the club's gone slightly over the last couple of years with regard to tickets, because I think, you know, there was the big issue around home ticket sharing, and then they brought in a system, and I think that system as well is flawed, massively flawed in terms of the ticket sharing. I don't think there's too much of an issue in paying £20 to have the ability to share your ticket. What I object to is making someone pay £40 to be able to receive it.
That's not going to sell the club to them, is it?
There's no incentive there to get new people into the Albion. Exactly. And that's what ticket sharing is about. It's getting other people to come to those games. But I think I don't think this is a Paul Barber issue, personally. I think Paul Barber doesn't get involved in the nitty gritty of ticketing policy. And I think this is led by the ticketing team and those that have had to deal with these issues, which are unfortunate this year. But my personal view is, deal with the individuals that are causing the issues. Don't vilify an entire fan base and your most loyal supporters and make them out to be doing something wrong and prove they're innocent.
Yeah, she did.
It's probably the 10-match ban. If they enforce that, or even a longer match ban, if you want to, if people are caught causing trouble on someone's ticket who shouldn't
be. Yeah, that would be a longer ban then.
Yeah, have a 20-match ban or something like that. If you for the season ticket holder, if they're giving a season ticket out, even if they don't know the person, it's their stupidity to doing that. It's
disproportionate amount of time, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be banned for, plus the away games, of course, during that period as well.
The other thing just to add is, The difference between home and away. Home games, I get to the stadium probably an hour, just over an hour before. Away games, probably 15 minutes before kickoff on average.
Yeah.
And that's the same for most people, I think. So you get the flood of 2,000 people, say, 15, 20 minutes before the game. It's going to cause mayhem if they're doing random ID checks. The other thing that I worry about is, are they actually going to be random ID checks? Or are they going to target people that are younger, that are dressed a certain way, because they think that they're the ones that are troublemakers and pick out those. And I think that that's another kind of concern for me on this policy.
Quite possibly. And just one thing that was also in the email from Jenny was that she did say that, because I asked her about this, and she said, if, you know, we might look to target people whose behaviour we've noticed as suspicious online. So people where they can identify, I guess, because obviously you don't always know who someone on social media is, but wherever they're able to identify this is a suspicious, potentially suspicious season ticket holder user, they might target them. But other than that, it's random. That's what she clarified. But ultimately, it's too inconvenient. There's enough inconveniences with going to the games as it is. Bollocks to that, to be honest. If that starts becoming a hassle, then that's going to be too much. Brentford, yeah, that probably won't be a problem because they've got the person near the gate. But again, it's an extra hassle, isn't it?
It could be, though, because people are coming from work. People are working on Friday.
We're
lucky for Friday because we're coming from London only, and I've got, like, when I finish work at 3 or something like that. But I know people who you know, people will be coming from Brighton after finishing work.
Yeah.
They'll be very, very tight to get there for the kickoff. Mm. And if they've been picked for that, then... you know, they're going to be screwed. It's like we don't, and no one's got any idea how long that queue is going to be. You know, once Friday's over and we see it, even though it's going to be a different time, we'll have a rough idea of how many people might have actually had that come up. Yeah. It's like 20 or 50 or 100, or no one really knows the number of people affected, really.
Yeah, they've said smallish numbers, but what does that mean? Also, I've got a bit of a concern. So I don't know if it is Paul Barber or the ticket people, whoever it is that's driving this, but I have got a concern with the... this is not for discussion element. FAB, the Fan Advisory Board, were supposedly set up in order to allow a form of communication between the club and a representation of fans, and yet they weren't consulted on this. As I understand it, they were emailed with a heads up saying we're going to be doing this, but they weren't actually consulted about it. Isn't that the whole point of it? Obviously, they don't think this particular issue is... but that is an issue for me, because I think this is precisely what the more emotive issues are the ones you need to smooth over with fans and try and find some medium ground, aren't they?
The issues that have kind of pushed the club to create that fan advisory board is poor communications with fans and fans getting upset because they're not being communicated to properly. Yeah. And this is a perfect example of it, because you could introduce something but not make away fans out to be the root cause and your most loyal fan base out to be villains or breaking rules and have to prove themselves otherwise. But I think there's a wider thing with the Fan Advisory Board at the moment where it feels like a bit of lip service.
Exactly.
And
that's my impression.
You know, where are the minutes of the meetings? Because surely the Fan Advisory Board... should be kind of held to account by the fan base, because they're meant to be representing us. But how can they represent us if we don't know what's being spoken about, if we don't know what's actually being discussed at those meetings, and if we can't feed into those discussions?
Yeah, Peter and I are on the committee for Seagulls Over London. There's minutes of every committee meeting we have. There's no real kind of need for it, except for the fact that it's the protocol. If we're doing it, why the hell aren't they? Because it's much more people involved in that. Obviously, it's the whole of the fan base. And I think the club are being very kind of shut-doored about this. They're just, you know, we're not discussing this issue. Same with Bottle Tops, which has got this mixture of being, always brings a smile. We're both smiling on the screen. It is ridiculous in one sense, but it's also actually pretty irritating.
One example where it was extremely irritating is the Newcastle game, because I was in the East for the Newcastle game. It was absolutely boiling. You know, it's like one of the hottest days of the year. Yeah. And it's very hard to, you know, if you put your water bottle down without any water, without a lid on it, it's a fair chance you'll knock it over and then the water will go all over the place and basically get all your bags wet and all stuff. Like, if you hold it in your hand, if you jump up, then it could get wet. It's potentially causing serious health issues. Isn't it?
And it's also costing people money, because then they're having to spend money at premium prices to get another bottle of water.
The club probably want that.
Well, the club will want that, but you don't want that for your club budget.
I actually managed to get a bottle of 7-Up for someone on Saturday with a bottle cap on.
Oh, you're going to get
a ban coming up for you, Tom. You're in trouble.
I clarify, it wasn't for me.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
No, that's even worse. You're passing it off to someone else and coming a bottle top.
But I trust them, though.
This is a closed issue. The club will not discuss it with anyone anymore. But the communications is an issue. And Tom, you said about communications. The fact that when I read that thing about the ticket, the way tickets, I was fuming because I thought, well, this is going to be a big inconvenience to me socially. Actually, it's going to be variable, as she said when I emailed. So I'm getting a bit of clarification. Why isn't all of that clarification in the initial email to all members? Just to get as much information in there. So, because my issue is if it's going to be the ticket office versus outside the turnstile, that's a big difference for me personally.
Yeah, because it's the difference between having our own defined person for away fans or having to go and queue with the home fans as well. And
so I took the trouble to email, and to be fair, the club do, you know, are very good at getting emails back to people. That's fine. But how many people are not emailing? They're just going off into a fume about it. And then there's Chinese whispers and, you know, people are inventing new kind of concepts of what they think is going to happen, which then turn into supposed facts. And this is where you end up with a lot of disgruntlement, isn't it?
That's the thing, though. I mean, on one hand, you have someone like Paul Barber, who replies at all hours of the day really quickly and engages with fans over emails. And I don't know of any other chief exec of a Premier League team that is that accessible.
That is brilliant, to be fair.
And I think a lot of the time when you do get the emails from the club, they are generally quite good when they're that personal element. Yeah. The problem is the mass communication, and it frustrates the hell out of me because I do communications as a job and it's not difficult to get right.
Yeah.
And the club has people in the communications team that were there during the dark days of Bellotti, Archer and Stanley. They know what the club's been through. They know what the fans mean to the club and how the fans saved this club. Yet, the last few years, there's been a number of things where the fans that save the club are treated with disdain and are a second thought. And that's not right. You know, we need to remember our history. You know, enjoy today, enjoy this run. But in 10, 15 years, if we get relegated, you know, away tickets aren't going to be an issue. Bottle tops aren't going to be an issue. All of these things that are made out to be this big evil, it's just a flow of, you know, they're the issue now, but at some point in the future, they won't be. And we need to remember that and remember where we've come from.
I'll be honest, I came as close as I've ever been in the time I had a season ticket since about 99 to not having one this season. Last year, I missed quite a few home games for various reasons. And me and Russ went to Worthing a few times and I really liked that. And it was actually, I was really tempted to start. The reason I stuck with my season ticket is because you can't get away tickets for like London games, that sort of thing, without it. I didn't want to miss out on those. But the atmosphere at Amex last year was pretty dreadful. A lot of the games were awful. The transport was pretty awful generally as well. Quite often there were issues that every game seemed to have some sort of problem with getting there or getting back or something. And I felt
Give a shout out to Avanti Trains and how awful they are for weekend services and how they are making travel to away games the worst.
Yeah.
I've never known it to be so difficult to get to away games as this season. And all of these things add up and add up. And I'm sure there are people that are not bothering anymore because it is just too difficult and you have to jump through too many hurdles. And the club need to realise that, you know, people are going to switch off from their product and that's going to have knock-on effects.
Yeah, normally football's on the rise, for example.
It probably isn't a problem now, but where if we did go down or something like that, suddenly that drops attendances quite a bit and the experience is, you know, more of a problem when you're not in the Premier League anymore.
Yeah, more games, more home games, more travel issues. And the train
strike. More midweek games as well, which has been the major issue in the Championship.
These train strikes are disgusting. And in a time when everybody's having to budget, I cannot see the justification in them, really, on the grounds. If it's a safety issue, that's fine. If it's to do with pay or conditions or pensions, come on, guys. There's people who are losing a lot more money. People are losing money because they're self-employed and can't get from A to B. There's people who are losing money because they rely on clients using the trains. all those people are losing money while they're fighting to get more money, if that's what it's about. I know there's other issues as well. But
although I think a lot of the strikes are about helping the lowest paid in that industry.
Yeah.
And an industry where they haven't had pay rises in line with the private sector. Yes, there are self-employed people struggling as well. And there's so many industries that are struggling post-COVID and now going into kind of other effects. But ultimately, you also have to say that, you know, there's no effort to try and remedy it. And that's a form.
And it's just going to carry on at this rate. And I think the big difference now are post-COVID, whereas, you know, in the old days, it always used to be midweek strikes because people couldn't get to work. That was a major issue. Now, for most people, that's not such a big issue. You're not going to work because they can work from home in a post-COVID world. So what can they do instead? They target weekends, and weekends with big events on, with football on, with Glastonbury weekend was targeted only year and that sort of thing.
I mean, how much money did Brighton lose in as a city, Brighton and Hove as a city, last weekend alone, for example?
As I said, though, like, Avanti, it's actually hard to work out if there's a strike or not because the service is so terrible post-COVID and they're just trying to use COVID as a way to cover up for their failings, yet they get another 6-month contract. And I think across the board, the train companies are really, really impacting the football experience because they are not running the services that they should be. And that's a big issue. Also, the cost. I mean, I've noticed as going away from home, the number of cheap advance tickets available now, they're non-existent. So the cost of getting to games has more than doubled.
And you also can't buy them in the Premier League anyway, because you don't find out for about 6 weeks in advance when you're actually going to play anyway. So whereas in the old days in like League Two or whatever, you could buy 3 months in advance, wait for the train tickets to come available and get as cheap a option as possible. I've been to like Birmingham for like 6-7 quid return at one point, that sort of thing. Now with the Premier League, with the Sky announcements anyway, about 6 weeks before normally or something like that, 6-7 weeks, or any cheap tickets there are, aren't relevant to Premier League fans because there's no way of getting them anyway.
I mean, three figures for Northern games now.
Yeah, we did, before COVID in the Premier League, we did manage to get good deals, but now it's non-existent. And, you know, I want to try and get to games in a more sustainable way, but I'm being forced to drive because there's no other way to get there.
Exactly.
And so which then takes away the enjoyment anyway, because you can't have the same relaxed day with your mates and then have a few drinks. Yeah. And
it goes back to this whole point of, you know, this ticket policy that the club have brought in is vilifying the fans that are making sacrifices, and that's the big thing in life, that you plan everything around. And, you know, I'm just fearful that it will turn people off of that, and that will just negatively impact the atmosphere that we've talked about. It will negatively impact the club as a whole. And, you know, I just hope that the club actually listen, but based on recent form in terms of they've still maintained the home ticket swap to a very similar system, I just think it's going to fall on deaf ears.
Yeah, they did the kind of we listen thing and offered one free game, didn't they? Which, you know, it's not really...
they're ignoring the root cause of the issue, which is
exactly.
The person that receives it has to be a paid member, and that's the problem. They say they need to know who's in the stadium. Well, yeah, fine. It has to be someone registered on the.
Yeah, you can register. It's not a problem.
And pay a minimal admin fee and that sort of thing. But yeah, exactly. It means you're paying for something twice because you've already paid for your ticket, and then you're paying to give it to someone else, and they're paying as well. So it's like the club gets depriving money from it.
Depriving the possibility of new fans in general, and even just on the days that they visit, even if they never come again, they're going to spend some money probably on at least some refreshments, maybe some food. They might buy a program as it's a one-off in that scenario. The club are losing some income. Yes, they might be negated by costs of admin a bit, but come on, if it's got the potential to take new fans in, why not do that? And it's rubbing up the backs of fans when we're on to such a good thing, when we're so well run as a club, when everything's going so well, we're established in the Premier League, we're playing amazing football, generally the grounds are full, all of that's great, and yet we've got stuff that we shouldn't need to be complaining about, which we're now complaining about. And the club are robbing the fans up the wrong way, as you said. And if they've got any delusion that the majority of fans are not happy with elements of the ticket exchange and the bottle tops issue, then they are severely deluded, because everybody I know is at least mildly irritated, at the very least, with, say, this away scheme, for example, that's been introduced.
The other thing that's quite funny with the home one is, you know, they want people to, they want bums on seats, they want people there. The people that are more likely to need to be able to swap tickets are people that live further away. So my mate that I go with, he lives up near Stansted in Bishop Stortford. I have others that come down from Newcastle for games and from all over. They're not going to make every game. Yet these fans that are travelling hundreds of miles for a home game, they can't give their ticket to someone else because, you know, the likelihood of knowing a My Albion Plus member is reasonably slim. The likelihood of getting someone to sign up to be a My Albion Plus member is even slimmer. Yet they then also get a letter from the club basically chastising them for not coming to games and saying that they should effectively consider whether they hold a season ticket because they've not been to, say, 10 games in the season. But you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, exactly. Do they want us in on the seats or not? People are giving the money, but you know, paying for a season ticket, they can't come attend on a number of occasions. I've got a friend like that in the Northeast as well. That's fine, but yeah, those seats are going to go empty. Why not allow them to? I know they've got the ticket exchange, but let's face it, with all of the issues of trains and various other things, there are going to be more and more occasions when you're not going to resell out through the ticket exchange for a game like Spurs, which was originally, I'm sure, a sellout. It's not going to resell out because there's too many variables affecting whether or not enough new people who are just members rather than season ticket holders would want to come.
I think of the five or six times I've listed my ticket for resale, it sold once, although that was quite funny because it allowed myself and my mate to realise that we've sat in the wrong seats for the last 5 years and that my actual season ticket is the one that he sits in. And we only found out because he walked up and there was someone sat in his seat and he said, "Oh, are you in the right place?" And he showed him the ticket and he was. So we worked out that we've been sitting in the wrong seats for the last 5 years.
Excellent. Well, that's a ban there, right there, Tom. Right, we'd better wrap it up. It's an epic show here. Plenty to discuss, and we've got through it all eventually. It's been a pleasure to have you on for your debut, Tom. It's been brilliant. Thank you for joining us. Will you come back on?
Oh, absolutely.
Excellent. We can have another rant, maybe.
Yeah, if we find out if there's something to rant about, then we're all good.
Excellent, brilliant. It's really good having you on. So yeah, thank you for joining us, Peter, as always, of course, as well. We are going to do there's quite a bit going on this week. We're going to be doing a special with the Dogma Boys, meeting up with them in a pub in London on Thursday. So we're going to be doing a little bit of content for that, probably a match day special for Brentford. If not, it'll be a review afterwards. And we've also got our latest non-league match day special coming up soon, haven't we, Peter? Going down to Hastings for the day. More on that later on to follow. But in the meantime, stand or fall.
Up the Albion. Sports Social Podcast Network.